All right, good evening, everyone. It is a privilege to be back here. I don't know what number of year this is, but Baruch Hashem, it's been a number of years, and it's always wonderful to be able to come here and to learn with you a little bit. I'm always very taken by this group of wonderful people who take time, I'm sure out of busy schedules, to come and eat dinner and learn together and grow together. We've covered such a variety of different topics over the years, but this year I have to say that the ability to speak about Chassidus, and specifically I think my mandate tonight is to speak a little bit about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, I feel is an incredible, not just opportunity, but an incredible privilege, as Rabbi Nachman is one of my personal heroes. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov is an individual whose influence is felt. The truth is, I would venture to say, not just in the corners of the Hasidic world, I would say differently, not just in the Breslov movement, which is the movement of Hasidus that kind of took on his teachings, but Rabbi Nachman was one of those seminal figures who helped to shape Hasidus in general. And the fact, again, if you know, many like to call it the neo-Hasidic movement that is occurring today, which is a fascinating dynamic, how the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov and the teachings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov have become popularized, not just in Hasidic circles, but outside of Hasidic circles as well. It's a fascinating dynamic. I think it speaks a lot to the fact that people in today's day and age are not just looking for intellectual stimulation, but are also looking for inspiration. And the words of the Rebbe really serve both the intellect as well as the inspired soul. So I want to kind of preface my remarks by saying that there is no way in the course of one class that I could cover the totality of Rabbi Nachman. Then I'd follow up that by saying there's no way in two classes, three classes, four classes, or five classes. I give on Thursday nights, I give a small chabura on Rabbi Nachman's Torah, Likutei Halachos, Likutei Maharan, and I've been giving it, Baruch Hashem, for about 5, 6, 7 years or so. And the truth is, we're only skimming the surface. The Rebbe's works and the Rebbe's words and the Rebbe's insights are so profound. And the truth is, the amazing part is, this is a man who produced so much profound thought, and yet Rabbi Nachman died at the age of 39. Rabbi Nachman died as a young man. He died as a result of tuberculosis at the age of 39. Rabbi Nachman had an incredibly difficult life. Just as an aside, it's always fascinating to see that some of the people who make the most dramatic impact upon the Jewish people do so in a limited number of years. You know, when you think of the age 39, Rabbi Nachman died at 39, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Litzato, the author of Mesilas Yesharim, died at 39. I often take this very much to heart because a lot of us, the way we go through life, is we assume that there'll always be a future to accomplish. There's no need to buckle down and get serious now because there's always later on. Of course, that later on kind of moves as we get older, right? When I'm young, later on is 30. When I'm 30, later on is 50. When I'm 50, later on is 80, so on and so forth. And it's amazing. I find it very striking that could you imagine if Rabbi Nachman had done like many of us do in life, which is just put off the major accomplishments until later, right? I'll contribute later. I'll learn later. I'll write later. I'll grow later. What the world would have missed out without his beautiful spiritual and luminescent light. So in 39 short years, the Rebbe accomplished so much. A little bit about background of Rabbi Nachman. So first of all, Rabbi Nachman, like many of the other Hasidic masters, did not commit things to writing. The truth is, lest you think that this is unique by the Hasidic masters, another great Torah personality who I know we've discussed within these walls in past years, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was the same way. And actually, interestingly enough, they did it for the same reasons. The Rabbi Soloveitchik would not commit things to writing for one simple reason. He felt thought was evolving. And the way you think today, will be different than the way you think in a year from now, in 6 months from now, in a decade from now. In fact, many of people who spend years in the Rav's shir would often remark about how the Rav would be studying the same tractate, the same folio, the same tractate of Talmud, and yet again his ideas and his innovative thought processes would so dramatically change over the course of the year. The Rav felt the power of the written word is that it's written. And once it's written, it very much becomes solid, embedded, and almost to a certain degree immutable. Thought is always evolving. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that. Rabbi Nachman thought the same idea, which is why Rabbi Nachman did not really commit any of his writings. What we have from Rabbi Nachman were codified by his student, Rabbi Nosson. So to give you a little bit of brief biographical information on Rabbi Nachman. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov is born on April 4th, 1772, and he died October 16th, 1810. Rabbi Nachman's father was a man by the name of Simcha. Simcha himself was also an outstanding Torah scholar, and his mother was a woman by the name of Fega. Fega was the daughter of Adol. Adol was the daughter of the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh, Rabbi Saul Baal Shem Tov. So Rabbi Nachman, on his mother's side, was a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. Now this is exceptionally important, because although Rabbi Nachman, of course, never met his grandfather, his great-grandfather, the Baal Shem Tov plays a major role in Rabbi Nachman's development. Of course, all Rabbi Nachman has are the stories of his great-grandfather. He doesn't just have the stories. Rabbi Nachman grew up in the same house that the Baal Shem Tov lived in. Now, the truth is, when we think about Rabbi Nachman, I see Rabbi Nachman, you think? Uman, right? Or Nana Nachman, right? Uman. Uman is the great association with Rabbi Nachman. Understand, the only thing Rabbi Nachman did in Uman was... He didn't even die there. He didn't die in Uman. He's buried in Uman, right? He passed through Uman at an earlier time and in a very mystical moment said to his students, this would be a good place to be buried, and ultimately, again, is buried in Uman. Rabbi Nachman is born, lives his life, and has his greatest sphere of influence in a city called Mezhbiz. Mezhbiz in Ukraine was a very well-known city. It was also where the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh set up his original court. Mezhbiz is really the cradle of Hasidus. It's the beginning of Hasidic thought. It was a major Hasidic center. The Baal Shem Tov was there. The Baal Shem Tov's primary disciple, Baruch HaMezhbiz, was also there. And so in that home, and in fact, I put some of these pictures on the first page of your source sheet, because I thought it was amazing. Mezhbiz was already a major Jewish metropolis way before the Baal Shem Tov. In fact, again, the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, who you can see lived from 1561 to 1640, the Bach is one of the most important halachic commentaries we have on the Torah, right? The Torah, a halachic compendium that precedes the Shulchan Aruch. So you see already in the mid-1500s, Mezhbiz is a major Jewish city. You can see over here pictures of the Baal Shem Tov's shul. I apologize, it would have been better in color. My apologies. So that's the Baal Shem Tov's shul on the right-hand side, the middle picture, and then they rebuilt, not so long ago, recreated the Baal Shem Tov's shul. You see as it stands on the bottom of the right-hand corner. Interestingly enough, there were Jews in Mezhbiz all the way up until the Holocaust, all the way up until the war, and you could see to this very day there's a monument to the 3,000 Jews in Mezhbiz who were murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shon V'Zichram. And then on the bottom left-hand column, you have over there the grave of the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh. That is the Ohel. That is the structure that is built on top of the Baal Shem Tov's kever. I didn't put in a picture of Uman over here because I'm assuming you've all seen pictures of Uman. Hopefully, not pictures of everything that happens in Uman, but pictures of Uman, pictures of the Rebbe's kever that's there. And Uman, interestingly enough, has become the site. Truly, over the last couple of years, there were always groups of dedicated Hasidim who always travel to Uman. But the popularization of the pilgrimage to Uman is something that is fascinating, really taken off in the last couple of years. So Rabbi Nachman, therefore, again, born in 1772, a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh. So what I'd like to try to do with you this evening, for the little bit of time that we have, is to take you a little bit through the life of Rabbi Nachman. Again, I'm not going to do justice to the biography, but to kind of give you some of the major events that occurred in his life, some of the beautiful stories from his childhood. You could see the impact that his Alter Zeid, his great-grandfather, the Baal Shem Tov, had on his life, and then spend a little bit of time focusing on what I think are some of the major concepts that Rabbi Nachman wrote about. You know, if you look in the world of Hasidus, so every Rebbe has a couple of major points that they focus on. And the truth is, most of their writings really seem to coalesce around those points. So for example, the Noam Elimelech, Rabbi Elimelech of Lezhensk. If you look at his sefer, he focuses very much on the power of a tzaddik, the power of attaching yourself to great people. Rav Levi Yitzchak Berdichev was known ultimately again as Sani Goren Shel Yisrael, who was the defender of the Jewish people. Rav Levi Yitzchak Berdichev is famous for always finding the good in the Jew, even when the Jew is not all that great. Rabbi Nachman has a couple of core concepts that are really pivotal in his writings, which we're going to explore a little bit this evening as well. I'm going to quote you from a couple of sections from a sefer that's titled Pu'ulas HaTzadik. Pu'ulas HaTzadik was compiled again by Rabbi Nachman's primary disciple, Rabbi Nassan. And what Rabbi Nassan tried to do is through the use of stories. Remember again, the use of stories in Chassidus is also exceptionally important. You know, there are two ways that you could speak about a Chassidic story. You could say, I have a Chassidish Maisa, or you could say, what a Chassidish Maisa, right? And the intonation is everything, right? In the world of Chassidus, stories were an incredible way to convey messages. Is every single Chassidish Maisa true? I guess it depends who you ask, right? Right? I'm sorry? Every story has truth. Ann said it well. Every story has truth. Are there certain aspects that are embellished? Look, the truth is, we're no stranger to hyperbole. The Talmud is filled with stories that have hyperbole to add effect. So I think that's a wonderful way to say it. Every story has elements of truth. Is it totally true? The truth is, to a certain degree, it's irrelevant. Storytelling was a fundamental mechanism by which to teach and by which to convey lessons. And this leads to another very important point. What set aside the Baal Shem Tov, again, I'm not going to get into all of the controversies surrounding the founding of Chassidus, right? The Baal Shem Tov himself, the Baal Shem Tov was not a controversial person, but controversy found the Baal Shem Tov, because any time you try to start a new movement, it's always going to be mired in controversy. Of course, given the fact that, remember, the Baal Shem Tov comes on the scene not so long after Shabtai Tzvi, the Baal Shem Tov himself, again, put an incredible emphasis on Lurianic Kabbalah. Remember, anyone who even mentioned Lurianic Kabbalah within the decades after Shabtai Tzvi was automatically suspected of being a Sabbatian. I mentioned before the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was blacklisted, right? It's amazing. Today, you can't go into a yeshiva or a shul, a house of study, that doesn't have a copy of Mesilas Yesharim. It's like part of the basic diet of Musar. It's the most basic sefer that we learn. Ramchal is recognized. The Ramchal was blacklisted. An interesting story, the Ramchal, as an aside, the Ramchal had told his students, and again, whether or not he actually said this story, or this is what got out, but Ramchal spoke about the idea that he learned Kabbalah late at night, and when he had questions on Kabbalah, he was able to consult the angels. Whether or not he said this, or someone recounted this in his name, Ramchal was blacklisted. So understand what this means. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto could not go ahead and find a job teaching Torah anywhere. I don't mean like in the highest yeshivas. I mean like even the Talmud Torahs, right? Even the equivalent of Sunday schools. He could not find the job. That's how blacklisted he was, to the point that he had no choice but to move to Eretz Yisrael, right? He made Aliyah with his family and unfortunately, tragically died with almost his entire family within a very short amount of time after relocating to Israel. So the Baal Shem Tov, what was it that really marked the essence of Chassidus? Why was there a need? Was there really a need for a new movement in the Jewish people? We have no shortage of movements, right? We have no shortage of streams. We have no shortage of groups. The Baal Shem Tov had to come and start another one. The Baal Shem Tov had a very unique insight, which was that Judaism, Torah, had become the domain of the intellectually elite. If you knew how to learn, if you had skills, if you had background, then you had a seat at the table. What about for the masses? What about for the masses of people? What about for the unlearned? What about for those who didn't have the opportunities, those who didn't have the education? You know, sometimes we like to kind of create a little bit of, we engage a little bit of historical revisionism, you know, imagining what pre-war Europe was like. And we have this idea that everybody was a scholar and everybody was so well-versed and so knowledgeable. So that's factually incorrect. The truth is most people were ignorant. Most people had very rudimentary educations. And I'm talking about even in the observant community, most people knew very little. If they knew how to daven a little bit of tseno rena, right, then that was it. It was only the elite who went on. I remember my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, told me that at the age of 12, he came from a Hasidic family, and in an interesting anomaly, his parents sent him to the yeshiva of Nirvadik. Nirvadik was as far from Hasidic circles as one could possibly get. He was sent off at the age of 12 to go to Nirvadik. Amazing enough, he said he knew it was his bar mitzvah because he received a pair of tefillin in the mail. That's how he knew it was his bar mitzvah. And he said he was the only boy. He grew up in a community called Munkach. And he said there were a handful of boys who went on to higher learning. Everyone else learned a trade. So the Baal Shem Tov understood that there is a whole mass of people who are disconnected from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who are disconnected from God, who are disconnected from Torah, who are disconnected from spirituality. We need to create a portal. We need to create an entry point, not just for the learned, not just for the intellectually elite, but ultimately, again, for everyone to be able to find meaning and fulfillment in their Yiddishkeit. That is why the Baal Shem Tov understood that even in the most sincere displays of spirituality, heartfelt prayer, recitation of Tehillim, sharing stories, making a lechayim with another Jew, those could be forms of spiritual service as well. So you could imagine and appreciate why there was such a groundswell around the Baal Shem Tov, because people were thirsty for this, not for the lechayims, even for the chayims also, but people were thirsty for connection. People were thirsty to find their portal. People were thirsty to be able to find their avenue of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Torah, for the truth is, Torah is anything and everything for the people, for our people. Torah is the be-all and end-all of Judaism. There is no Judaism without a Torah. That is an incontrovertible truth. But at the end of the day, not everybody is capable of learning on the same level. And the truth is, not everybody finds fulfillment in the intellectual study of Torah. The Baal Shem Tov said, as long as you are sincere, there are many other avenues of connection. This is incredibly important because this is going to be a hallmark in Rabbi Nachman's thought as well. So a couple of interesting facts. If you take a look at the page numbers got a little bit cut off. So here, in the Sefer Pulas HaTzadiks, remember again, what Rabbi Nosson, who is the primary disciple of Rabbi Nachman, tries to do for us is to paint a little bit of a biographical sketch of Rabbi Nachman's life. So the truth is, he actually begins, you could see this is already paragraph Chaf Vav, paragraph 26. In the previous paragraphs, what Rabbi Nosson does is try to give us just a little bit of a window into Rabbi Nachman's grandparents, his parents, to see the home in which Rabbi Nachman grew up. Because again, a child like Rabbi Nachman does not just come about. Right, someone like that doesn't just happen. That's a result, ultimately, again, of generations of dedicated divine service to ultimately bring such a light to the world. So if you take a look at paragraph Chav Vav, this is actually a story about the Baal Shem Tov. But it's a story that, as we're going to see, has an incredible mark on Rabbi Nachman. He says, Achar HaSipurim Shezachal Lishmo'a Az, Va'or Ve'hiliv Es Levavo Ma'od Ma'od B'Teshuka Gidol Lav Yisbarach. So Rabbi Nachman always used to ask his parents about stories about the Baal Shem Tov. Remember again, we're going to see, amazingly enough, that he used to go ahead, he would learn in the same room that the Baal Shem Tov learned in. He lived in the same house that the Baal Shem Tov learned in. And therefore, he always desired stories. Tell me about my great-grandfather. So one of the stories that had a dramatic impact about Rabbi Nachman, and that Rabbi Nachman himself repeated many times over, was the following story. Paragraph B. Zeh HaSipur. Yadua ki Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh nolad la'avi Rabbi Eliezer kishahaya ben mea shanin uli imo sara. So as the story goes, his father was 100 years old and his mother was an elderly woman as well when they gave birth to him. So here's a perfect example. Was his father 100 and his mother somewhere around there? I don't know. But the point is, they were older, and they were childless for many years. They had the Baal Shem Tov later on in life. Little Yisrael. So his father was Eliezer. This is the Baal Shem Tov now we're talking about. Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. His father was Eliezer. His mother was Sarah. Tekef umiyad buhuledes habein mesa imo. Apparently, the Baal Shem Tov's mother died in childbirth. Ukishegi lishnas achamesh. Nechalash Aviv Ma'od. So the young Yisrael, this is before he's known as the Baal Shem Tov, right? Young Yisrael is 5 years old. Little boy, 5 years old, already grew up without a mother. His father became very ill when he was but 5 years old. Vikara espino eila va'amarlo b'lshon sava'a. And he calls his son, to him, and he commands him the following. You can see the Hebrew version of the Yiddish is in that footnote vav. Heve yodea ki yagia kitzi v'nitzarech lazo v'esolun kiderech kalaretz. So you have to imagine this scene. The Baal Shem Tov's father calls his little son to his bedside. And he tells his son, I'm going to die. I'm going to leave this world. Ki Hashem Yisbarach. But however, he says, but my child, al tifached b'ni mishum davar. Do not be afraid of anything. Do not be afraid of anything in this world. Why? Ki Hashem Yisbarach melo kala aretz kivodo. Because Hashem, because God is everywhere. V'tamit titzayir bedatcho. Always have in your mind's eye this image that God accompanies you on every step of your journey. You are never alone in anything you do in life. Therefore, when you need something in this world, remember this is a father on his deathbed saying this to his 5-year-old child. When you need something in this world, when you need something, don't rely on people. Rely on God. Rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ask Him for what you need. Umi'achar she'in shum mitzius biladav. Paragraph C. Targiles atzmecha ledaber imo yisparach. Beloshon sha'ata ragil. V'tamit teilech rak imo yisparach. And the Baal Shem Tov's father says to his young son, don't just pray. Don't just daven. Davening is beautiful. Prayer is incredible. The challenge of prayer is, it's someone else's words. It's someone else's words. Find a way to speak to God in your own words. Establish a dialogical connection with God with your own words. Ubemilim elu nistalik. Ultimately, again, with these words. So again, the Baal Shem Tov's father, right? Ultimately, his father Eliezer. The last words to his son, to his 5-year-old son, little Yisrael, two concepts. Number one, don't be afraid in life. And number two, establish a meaningful, personal, dialogical connection with God. Speak with God. Speak with God using your own words. And when you need something, reach out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eliezer dies. Nistalek lochotz va'asa rash. Little boy runs out into the street, yelling, my father died, my father died. Uba'u b'nei adam v'kavru es aviv. And the Chevra Kadisha came along. They buried Eliezer. V'hu nishar yasom b'li abba v'ima. And at 5 years old, little Yisrael is left without a father and without a mother. He is all alone in this world. Ach divrei aviv, shediber imo kodim istakluso. Nechiku heitiv b'libo atzair. V'aso etzlo roshem chazak. V'hischil ledaber imo yisparach. But the final words of his father made a dramatic impact on this little boy. And from that day forward, he forged a meaningful, personalistic, dialogical connection with God. Speaking to God, not just from the words of his siddur, but from the words of his heart. It's a heartbreaking story. And this little boy, 5 years old, became a wanderer. Going from town to town, his clothing torn and tattered, for there was no one to look after him. And wherever he would sleep at night, in some beis medrash, some shul, by the next morning he was already gone. And he would wander. Fields, forests. Ach bedavar echad hayachazek ma'od ma'od. Lekayim tzavas aviv lach kok bedaito shein shum mitzias blado yisbarach klal. But the words of his father, the words of Eliezer, became the guiding light for this little boy. Rely on no one ultimately except HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rely on God for everything you need and speak to him in your own words. U'b'chol tenua u'tenua sham alufo shel olam v'utzarech rak ledaber imo yisbarach. So the truth is, It's an amazing story just about the childhood of the Baal Shem Tov. Orphaned from both parents by the age of 5, no one to look after him, wandering city to city, and yet again making something dramatic of himself. There's, of course, much more to the story of the Baal Shem Tov. But Rabbi Nosson writes that this story was one of the most impactful stories on Rabbi Nachman. Impactful, impact is measured by the fact that this was one of the stories that Rabbi Nachman himself would share most often. And we're going to see that these were two things that Rabbi Nachman very much took to heart. Number one, don't rely on people. Now, that if you say that, it sounds a little bit like cynical, right? Or jaded, don't rely on people. But the truth is, there's a profundity to that. What does it mean, don't rely on people? That if you want to accomplish something in life, do not look to anyone else to help you. If you want something from life, there's only two entities, right? One person and one entity are going to make that happen. You and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't rely on other people to make things happen for you. The truth is, this is not the Baal Shem Tov who came up with this. Already the Gemara itself, the Talmud is filled with stories like this, like Menemaut, Rabbi Elazar ben Drudja, and others who coined the phrase, Ein Hadavar Talui Ela Bi. The greatest mistake we make in life is that we outsource our success to other people. Right? There are things I wanted to accomplish. Why didn't I accomplish? Well, I can tell you. Because he didn't do this, and she didn't do this, and my mother didn't love me enough, my father didn't play ball with me enough, my second grade teacher wasn't nice enough to me, I didn't have the opportunities, I should have gotten in here, I should have been able to do this, and that's all the reasons that I didn't accomplish the things I want to accomplish in life. That's fantastic, except it's fundamentally false. At the end of the day, the reason I don't accomplish certain things in life, certain things is true. There are circumstances beyond my control that I simply cannot help. But there are so many times in life that I don't accomplish what I really wanted to accomplish because I simply didn't try hard enough. I didn't push myself hard enough, or I made the fatal flaw of outsourcing my success, placing the reins of my destiny in the hands of someone else. So Eliezer, who is already an old man, says to his little boy, 5 years old, do not rely on other people. If you want something in life, you need to make it happen. And if you put in your effort and you forge a meaningful relationship with God, then there is no telling what you could accomplish. Rabbi Nosson goes on and explains how this dramatic impact, we're going to see, by the way, the other piece that has a dramatic impact on Rabbi Nachman is that the Baal Shem Tov was a little boy who the community did not take care of. There's a tragic element in this story, which is a little boy was orphaned, and where was everyone? Where was the community? Where were people? And so much of Rabbi Nachman's writings are filled with this concept that your spirituality can never come at the expense of human sensitivity. Sometimes people think that the cultivation of personalistic spirituality exempts me from other obligations. I don't have to worry about you if I'm trying to go ahead and come closer to God. And Rabbi Nachman, that happened. That happened to his great-grandfather. Whatever it is, I'm sure the people of the town of Mezhes were very nice people. But somehow, some way, a 5-year-old orphan became a wandering vagrant from town to town in tattered clothing. And if it happened to one, it probably happened to more than one as well. Rabbi Nachman, this story broke, on one hand, it energized him to become the best version of himself, but it broke his heart knowing that his great-grandfather, it's hard to imagine a little boy 5 years old with no one to look after him, wandering from town to town, sleeping on benches. And by the way, what this means is he went from town to town, which means people saw a little boy in tattered clothing on the benches of the shul of the Beis Medrash. So people came to daven, they saw him there, and they left. Again, it's human nature. We often get so self-absorbed that we just don't see what's happening around us. But Rabbi Nachman used this story as an incredible springboard for another fundamental piece of his hashkafa. Your spirituality can never come at the expense of your human sensitivity. Empathy, compassion, looking out for the other are just as important as the cultivation of your personalistic spirituality. It goes on, another couple of interesting examples. If you turn to page 3, another incredible story, page 2, letter A. So just to give you an idea, I find these stories, again, fascinating, because also they give you a little bit, to me, one of the most fascinating things that I like to read about and I like to understand is how great people become great, right? People aren't born great. All of us are born with abilities and talents. And it's interesting to see that some people go on to become great and some people just remain mediocre. So I'm always fascinated by this, like, what makes great people great? How is it that great people rise above everything else? So that's why, personally, I always find these stories of tzaddikim incredible, because even if they're not all true, right, but some part of it is true, there are elements here that help you understand how some people transcend the natural inclination to remain at a level of mediocrity. So take a look at paragraph A. So Rabbi Nassim tells here a story about Rabbi Nachman when he was a little boy. What would he do when he was a little boy? So by the way, little, just so you understand in this, little means the stage before bar mitzvah. Rabbi Nachman gets married after his bar mitzvah. Mazel tov, the bar mitzvah is on Shabbos, I think Rosh Chodesh Nisan, right? And he gets married about a week later. So when you see any of his stories about his youth, youth means pre-bar mitzvah. So just so you have an understanding over here. So Rabbi Nachman v'hayah noy b'yamim elu shayakata, when he was a little boy, below the age of bar mitzvah, she'elokeach kama matbeos gidolim. Listen to what he would do. So his parents, I guess, would give him some money for whatever it was, tzedakah, whatever it is. So they would give him larger coins, and he would do something very interesting. Ve'chlifam al tfeilim. So the first thing he would do when he would get to the shul, base madrash, whatever he would do is, if you can imagine, they gave him a dollar, he exchanged the dollar for 100 pennies. Okay, why? Ve'nichnas la'beis haknesas ba'atznia derech halom. He would walk into the shul, but he would do it secretly. He'd come in through the window. Ukiyotze. Now the truth is, this is another part which we're not going to touch on today. This concept, Rabbi Nachman did this, the Baal Shem Tov did this, many did this, about keeping their personal piety exceptionally private. Exceptionally private. Really not letting anyone know, sometimes even their closest relatives. In fact, one of the fascinating things that happened in Rabbi Nachman's life is Rabbi Nachman married into a very prominent and wealthy family. And the reason that he was taken as a son-in-law to one of the most prominent and wealthy families was because they saw him as an incredible, abutting Talmud Chacham, abutting Torah scholar. And therefore, the Shver, the father-in-law, thought it would be a big privilege. So Rabbi Nachman did such a good job at hiding his personal piety that his father-in-law thought he was a fraud. His father-in-law thought that he got sold a bill of goods, and actually, again, it was only a number of years later that his father-in-law discovered who he really was. And again, there was pressure put upon Rabbi Nachman's wife to divorce her husband, to divorce Rabbi Nachman. Sorry, They say in Latin, an eisvarf, right? You're right. You married just such a mess up, right? Such a mess up. So you know what? You'll do better next time. So she knew who her husband was, but he made his wife really swear that she would not divulge who and what he was. There's a reason for that. And the reason for that is the moment that the greatness of great people becomes known, what happens? People gravitate towards them. And the moment that people gravitate towards a great person is the moment that they are thrust from obscurity into the public limelight. The moment that you're in the public eye is the moment that often you lose the ability to work on yourself, because ultimately, again, your time and your abilities are devoted to the community. So you see, the Baal Shem Tov did this, Rabbi Nachman did this, right? The Kotzker, Rabbi Nachman Mendel of Kotzk, was famous for doing this, actively driving people away. The Kotzker was a bit more of a sharper type of personality, driving people away, saying, go away, I don't want anything, all in an effort to try to work on themselves. So Rabbi Nachman, this is when he's a little boy. So already when he's a little boy, he does this practice quietly and secretly. He comes in through the wall of the shul, sorry, the window of the shul, and what does he do? V'lakach imu ha-sefer sharit tzion, v'armar ha-leshem yichud sha-asiyas mitzvah, v'lakach tafel echad v'ishlichu l'usach hamata b'seser, v'achar kach chazer va'asa atzmo, Let me tell you the rest of this outside. Rabbi Nachman do something fascinating. So you can imagine the scene, the parents gave him a dollar for tzedakah. Fantastic. So what would he do? He would go ahead and change it into 100 pennies. Then he would sneak into the shul. He would stand in front of the pushka. By the chassidim, there's a concept of l'shem yichud. That before you perform a mitzvah, there is a prayer, right? There's almost like an introductory prayer to the performance of mitzvah. Interestingly enough, it appears, I don't know why this is, but you see many people tend to do this on the night of the Seder. In fact, if you look at many of the Haggadahs, the L'shem Yichud are often printed there. Chassidim often do this throughout the entire year. The idea is that a mitzvah is something spectacular, meaningful, spiritually uplifting, and cathartic. As such, you can't just jump into it. You have to prepare yourself for it. So you have to imagine this scene. Rabbi Nachman takes his dollar, converts it into 100 pennies. He stands by the pushka, stands by the tzedakah box. L'shem yichud kodesh brichu shchinte b'dechir rochimu harini mukhla mazan kaimitz. I say, shal tzedakah. Puts in a penny. Takes out the second penny. L'shem yichud kodesh brichu. Okay, so obviously he had some time on his hands. Right? So what happens? 100 pennies, 100 times, each time going ahead and performing the mitzvah. Why would he do this? Ask you, why would he do this? What do you think? I'm sorry? So 100, if that's what he does, but what is he aiming for?
Many mitzvahs. Each mitzvah has a tikkun.
Consistency, continuity in the performance of mitzvahs. Rabbi Nachman understood the greatest challenge that we often face in our Judaism is consistency. The truth is, the greatest challenge we often face in life is consistency. Human beings are generally not consistent beings. But any meaningful relationship requires a sense of consistency, right? Think about it. In marriage, if a couple gets married and a man says to his wife, here's the deal, I'm going to be an excellent husband on Mondays, Wednesdays, alternate Fridays. The rest of the time is me time. I need time for me also. I'm going to be great on those times. Of course, it doesn't work. Any meaningful relationship requires consistency. Our relationship with God is no different. If you want, people wonder sometimes, why am I not inspired? Why don't? So again, if I'm not inspired, I have to ask myself a simple question. Am I consistent in my relationship with God? Inspiration is a byproduct of consistency. If I'm showing up every day and doing what I'm supposed to do for God, inspiration is sure to follow. There must be, so Rabbi Nachman understood something even as a little boy, that there's a difference between putting a dollar bill in the tzedakah box versus what? 100 pennies. Even though, again, it's the same amount of money to tzedakah, but it's two fundamentally different acts. One is one act, one is 100 acts. It's the same amount of money to tzedakah, same amount of money to tzedakah. Rabbi Nachman understood 100 times of giving makes you into a giver. Makes you into a giver. Sustained activity fundamentally changes who you are. Even though, again, each one of those little acts of giving is only a penny, but sustained activity fundamentally changes. By the way, just so you should know, this has halachic ramifications as well. They asked this shaila to Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe finds in Zecher Tzadik Livracha, which is a question that all of us encounter. All of us encounter. Ask Rav Moshe, I get 100 pieces of mail for all various organizations, right? Everything. New organization. No one produces organizations like Klal Yisrael, right? An incredible thing. New organizations every day. So I have a simple Hilchos Tzedakah question, laws of charity question. Should I give a little to a lot or a lot to a little? And Rav Moshe says, better to give a little to a lot. Now, by the way, that happens to be a source of debate. Not everybody agrees with that in Hilchos Tzedakah. Some say that a lot to a little is the ability to make a difference with your tzedakah. Rav Moshe actually paskin that a little to a lot is better. Why? Because it transforms you into a giver. Rav Moshe says if you give a lot to a little, that's fantastic. I don't know if that makes you a giver. Writing out a bunch of smaller checks over and over and over again fundamentally changes who you are. So you see Rabbi Nachman as a little boy already understanding that this idea of giving a lot, even though, or I should say, giving often, repeated activity, reinforced action. This, by the way, trickled into the way Rabbi Nachman learned. If you have a yeshiva background, what I'm going to tell you is going to be terribly offensive. Rabbi Nachman had a fascinating approach to learning. Rabbi Nachman's idea was that if you get to a section in Torah that you don't understand, so if you have a good yeshiva background, so you know if you don't understand something, what do you do? What do? You stick with it until you understand it. It takes you a day, it takes you a week, it takes you a month. Rabbi Nachman says, if you don't understand it, move on. Move on. And he says something amazing. He says, and again, to the chassidically challenged, this like hurts the ears, right? He says, don't worry, just keep on learning and you'll come to understand it. This idea, Rabbi Nachman says, what's the goal in Torah learning? Is the goal the absorption of information, or is the goal to become a learner? Is the goal ultimately, again, to absorb facts, or is the goal ultimately to transform yourself into someone who learns Torah? So again, in all fairness, this is a fundamental dispute within the ranks of the Jewish people. Some will say no, that the goal of learning is to learn information, to absorb information, to retain information. And if you walk away and you don't remember what you learned, then ultimately, again, not a total exercise in futility, but at least a partial exercise in futility. Well, in the Derech HaChassidus, that's not why you learn. Derech HaChassidus, you learn because when you learn Torah, you come close to God. When you learn Torah, it's a window into the mind of God. Retention is a bonus. Retention is a bonus. But that is not the goal. The goal is to engage in the process. The goal is to exert myself in the process. If I do that, then I'm successful. If I retain, matovo ma'no'im, even better. So Rabbi Nachman, when he would get to something that he would not understand, would move forward. Rabbi Nachman also had a very fast pace of learning. Very fast pace of learning, because this was his general derech. A few more interesting ideas. If you turn the page. So in paragraphs A and B, we're not going to do this inside, but Rabbi Nussan discusses Rabbi Nachman's daily regimen, right? How he learned. And he took on an incredible amount of learning responsibility coupled with the need to perform chesed, acts of kindness, every single day. So Rabbi Nussan records that often it was very difficult for Rabbi Nachman to sustain this, right? And at times he felt overwhelmed. I want to tell you something amazing about Rabbi Nachman, which we'll see in a little bit also. Rabbi Nachman, if you look in his writings, I mean, Rabbi Nussan's recordings of his writings, Rabbi Nachman is very real with his feelings. Rabbi Nachman speaks about being depressed at times. Rabbi Nachman speaks about the overwhelming feeling caught in the clutches of atzvus, of sadness. Rabbi Nachman speaks about feeling overwhelmed by all of the responsibility that sat on his shoulders. He did not paint a rosy picture of everything. He was incredibly real. So he discusses here how it was incredibly difficult to sometimes maintain the expectations that he set for himself. So how did he live? If you look at paragraph C, this is incredible. He said, "V'kacha isnai kol yemei yalduso lekabel ha'al asma ha'avoda biyom zeh v'lo histakel al yom ha'macharas klal." This is beautiful. Rabbi Nachman said, all you need to do is make good on today. Live for today. You know, as the famous adage goes, I don't know if it's a Mamar Chazal that says, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, right? Rabbi Nachman said, stop thinking about tomorrow, because you can't control tomorrow. The only thing you really have control over is how you live today. Maximize your today. When he would begin to get overwhelmed, how can I keep up this regiment of learning? How can I keep up these expectations of myself? Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about what's going to happen in a month from now. Focus on today. In fact, Rabbi Nachman, in the Kutei Halach, the Kutei Moharan, says something so beautiful on the Pasuk. It's actually the end of today's daf and daf yomi. When Moshe Rabbeinu says to Klal Yisrael, V'ata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elokecha Shoel Mi'imach. Kiyim liyira also. What does God ask of you except to fear him? And the Gemara is all bothered by that. Moshe Rabbeinu makes it sound like fear and reverence and awe of God is such a small thing. Rabbi Nachman reads that pasuk differently. He reads it, you know, the great thing about the Hasidic masters is they also are able to liberally use punctuation. So Rabbi Nachman understands the pasuk as saying, V'ata kama, ma yisra, ma Hashem Elokecha shom imach. The only thing that God asks of you is the ata, right now. God does not ask you for promises about the future for one simple reason, which is none of us can make promises about the future, right? This is the great falsehood that we often live with. We think that we can make promises and assurances about the future, but if we're honest with ourselves, we absolutely cannot. We can't control anything beyond the moment that is in front of me right now. So from the time, and a lot of times, Rabbi Nachman understood that a lot of times in life we become overwhelmed and anxiety laden because there are things we want to do and we don't know if we could go ahead and be consistent or guarantee the future. And Rabbi Nachman understood from a young age, you can't guarantee anything about the future. The only thing you can do is maximize your here and now. Maximize your ata. Maximize today. Tomorrow, we'll figure out tomorrow ultimately again when we get to it. If you look at paragraph D, another interesting idea. This is actually quite fascinating. V'haya ragil b'nedarim ma'od ma'od. Rabbi Nachman used to make nedarim. What are nedarim? Vows. Now, if I were to ask you, what is Judaism's view on vows? What would you say? Be careful. Good. Well said. Right? In fact, again, there's major disputes in the Talmud about this. Are vows a good thing? Are vows not a good thing? So you have opinions in the Talmud that say, Kala noder ein elechote. If you make vows, you're a sinner. You're a sinner. You're setting yourself up to violate your vows. Others say vows are wonderful things. A dispute. Machlokas in the Gemara. Rabbi Nachman always used to make vows. Shekama pamim kishaba yom kibal alav b'neder kol seder avod. When the day would start, he would say, I make a neder, I vow that I'm going to accomplish so and so and so and so. Why would he make vows? Why would he make vows? So understand, the death knell of any life initiative, right? The death knell of any life is, you want to start something in life, how do you know from the beginning you're not going to be successful? If you say three words, what are the three words that are the death knell of any life initiative?
Can't do it.
I will try. I will try. Note the parentheses of I will try is, I will try means I'm going to try, but most probably I'm not going to succeed. And I'm giving myself the out. I'm giving myself the out. I don't want to create pressure. So I'll try. I'll try. I'll try my best. Parentheses, I'm most probably going to fail because I've already given myself the license to fail. You know what the power of a nether is? A neder creates. There's no back door. You can't get out. I mean, you can technically, but it's a process, right? When it comes to a neder, what you're creating for yourself is an expectation. Rabbi Nachman understood if you want to succeed in life, set expectations for yourself and set high expectations and don't say, I'm going to try. Say, I vow. I vow. Rabbi Nachman would start every single day. Now again, I want to point out, there would be many who would fundamentally disagree with this process. But even if you disagree with the process, what a profound mindset. I begin every single day, not just with a wish list, not just with a to-do list, not just with dreams and aspirations, nedarim. I make a vow that I'm going to accomplish A, B, C, D, and D. Because if I make a vow, there's no choice but to accomplish. If I make a vow, there's no choice but to deliver. How many times in life do we not fulfill our dreams and aspirations simply because we gave ourselves a way out? We gave ourselves, right? Give people a way out. Give yourself a way out the back door. 9 out of 10 times we're going to take it. But at the end of the day, if something becomes a binding obligation, then the job must get done. A couple of other examples. Turn the page. If you go to page 4. So this is actually quite fascinating. This is really amazing. V'siper shebimeinu urav haya shakua b'chumros yeseros harbe. Rabbi Nachman, when he was little, was all into chumros, all into stringencies. There wasn't a stringency that Rabbi Nachman didn't meet that he didn't like. Right? Every single stringency he took upon himself. Rabbi Nachman goes on and he explains really wild stuff. Something amazing happens. If you skip down to paragraph B, v'acher kach b'imei gadluso, Hayamasir ma'od ma'od as hanashav, livroach Mikol minei chumros yiselos afilu bepesach. Rabbi Nachman got older. He encouraged his followers not to take on every stringency, to run away from certain stringencies, and even on Pesach. No chumras on Pesach. It sounds like sacrilege, right? It's not chumras. Even on Pesach, Rabbi Nachman. So listen to this. And he was very, this was a concept that he stressed over and over and over. So again, paragraph B. La'avot osa yisbarach betemimus ubepshitus gamar beli shum tzad chumra klal. Rabbi Nachman felt that there's enough built in halacha that makes it a challenge enough to worship God in a normal way. We don't have to add on additional layers. Now, this is incredible. Now, what changed? Rabbi Nachman realized that when he was young and he piled on all of these chumras, he was miserable. He said, Jews aren't going to connect with God if their Judaism makes them miserable. Remember, again, as we're going to see, Rabbi Nachman was the author of perhaps one of the most famous statements we have in Judaism, which is Mitzvah Gedola Lihios Besimcha Tamid. Now, again, we'll see what that means, right? That ultimately, again, it is a mitzvah to always be in a state of joy. Now, what joy means by it does not mean a smile on your face. We're going to discuss that in just a little bit. But Rabbi Nachman understood, remember again, Rabbi Nachman understood that if the goal is to allow Jews to feel a sense of dveikus, to feel a sense of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to feel happiness and joy in their Yiddishkeit, and not to feel like a ton of bricks sitting on top of my shoulders, then let's do what the halacha tells us to do. And let's be vigilant, and let's be excellent in the performance of the details of halacha, and let's not add on where we don't have to add on. So again, I want to be clear. Don't mistake Rabbi Nachman's not taking on chumras as an erosion of halachic standards of Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is Shulchan Aruch. There's no exceptions, Shulchan Aruch. That's the halacha. But at the end of Rabbi Nachman, and what's amazing about this is his own personal journey. From a youth filled with chumras, with stringencies, to an adult life spent telling his followers, please do not take on additional stringencies, even Pesach. Remember, Rabbi Nassan adds in Pesach over here, why? I don't have to tell you why. You all know why. Because again, even those who don't take on stringencies the rest of the year, Pesach is Mamish Kodesh Kadoshim. It's the Holy of Holies. Right? Every stringency out of the book, even stringencies that people tend to make up themselves, somehow become included in the body of law known as Hilchos Pesach. But this is Rabbi Nachman, and this is such a fundamental shift. Rabbi Nachman understanding that the goal ultimately is to create a Judaism that is beautiful, that is engaging, that is rewarding, that is fulfilling, that makes people want to come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now remember, this is not Rabbi Nachman's brainchild. He understood this to be the mandate from the Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh. This is why the Baal Shem Tov started Chassidus, to be able to bring Jews closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to create an engaging, meaningful, uplifting, inspiring model of Yiddishkeit that ultimately, again, could appeal to the masses. Rabbi Nachman is just continuing on that same journey as his grandfather. So now you've seen a little bit regarding some of Rabbi Nachman's background, his childhood. Of course, there's so much more stories of his marriage, stories of his young adult life, stories as when he becomes recognized. He was able to hide his identity for a good number of years, but by the time he reaches his early 20s, pretty much everyone knows who he is. He's cast into the public light. But Rabbi Nachman has his shares of adversity. Rabbi Nachman loses two children in infancy, and these things took their toll on him. Rabbi Nachman writes about it. Rabbi Nachman writes about the Mara Shechora. Mara Shechora means the bitter darkness that sometimes enveloped him. The profound struggle with the ability to see the light sometimes when life was so incredibly difficult. Rabbi Nachman was a very real person. I think the reason why he had such a dramatic impact, and the reason why his writings, even today, are so incredibly popular, is because they speak to the reality of the human condition. So a couple of fundamental ideas that are major dominant themes in Rabbi Nachman's writings. So I'm sharing with you, there's so much more, but I'll just share with you really two to focus on. One of them comes, if you take a look on page 5, this is actually This is actually from, well, the truth is, I really focus on one area. So Rabbi Nachman writes about this in Chanukah, Likutei Halachos. So Rabbi Nachman, remember, in Likutei Halachos, just to give you an idea, Likutei Moharan, right, which literally means the collections, Moharan is, right, Moreno Harav Rabbeinu Rabbi Nachman, right? So that's Rabbi Nassan's compilation of Rabbi Nachman's teachings. There's another work called Likutei Halachos, where essentially Rabbi Nachman went through Shulchan Aruch and he did something amazing. Part of the beauty of Chassidus in general, you find this not unique to Rabbi Nachman, but what I find one of the most incredible and rewarding aspects of Chassidus is that there's a recognition that every statement or every pasuk, every verse, every halacha has two dimensions. It has the stated dimension, and then it has what we'll call the meaningful dimension. So you could look at any pasuk in the Torah, any verse, and there is the stated meaning, the stated mitzvah, but there's also what's called the panemius. There's the inner dimension, the inner deeper understanding. The same thing is halacha. We often think that halacha, Jewish law, is a series of do's and don'ts. But in reality, Jewish law is often the way that the rabbis taught us, a system of morality and ethics. And if you delve deep enough into any law, you can extrapolate not just a legal reality or a legal statement, but a moral ethical lesson as well. So Rabbi Nachman does this in Hilchos Chanukah. He points out something absolutely amazing. See, he writes, there's an interesting halach, an interesting law by Hilchos Chanukah, which is that the menorah, see, it's different. Remember, we're more used to the diaspora performance of the mitzvah, which is we light inside our home. That's where the mitzvah takes place. And if you happen to have a window that faces the public domain, even better. But the truth is, the window facing public domain, in fact, is like a bonus. You don't even have to have that. Technically speaking, you could light it anywhere in your home where your family members are going to see it and you fulfill the mitzvah. But of course, we know that's not the original form of the mitzvah. The original form of the mitzvah, where did you light? Outside. And by the way, not just outside, but remember, especially in Talmudic homes, where often what you had is you had a home, you had a courtyard, and the courtyard itself also had an entranceway. So not only would you light outside your home, but where would you light? You would light outside the entranceway to your courtyard. So your menorah was actually right by the public thoroughfare, what we call the Rosh Sarabin, the public domain, by the street. Not only that, the menorah, interestingly enough, was lit where? It was lit lamata miyut tfachim, less than 10 tfachim off the ground. So just so you understand, so a tafach is about 3.5 inches, right? So let's say 10 tfachim, we'll call it within 3.5 to 4 feet, right? So within 4 feet of the ground. So really, if you think about it, you're lighting your menorah low down, and in the public thoroughfare, right by the entranceway. Rabbi Nachman says something so incredibly beautiful. He says, what's the message here? He says, ultimately, again, lamata miyud, this concept of below 10 tfachim, represents the parts of my persona that are without light. The parts of me that are just damaged, that are just broken. He goes through, I'm not going to go through the whole thing right now, but he discusses the idea, the Gemara says, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, never descends below 10 tefachim. For example, in the Mishkan, in the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, the Shekhinah resided between the Kruvim, the two cherub-like figures that were perched on the lid of the ark. That was above 10 tefachim. The Shekhinah never comes down. So Rabbi Nachman says something amazing. Rabbi Nachman says, what's the symbolism of bringing the light within 10 tefachim? What's the symbolism there? Rabbi Nachman says, don't be afraid to shed light on the most broken parts of your persona. We all have things inside of us that are broken and in a state of disrepair. And more often than not, what we choose to do with those things are ignore them and pretend like they don't exist for one simple reason. I'm too scared to confront it. I don't want to confront my frailties. I don't want to confront my faults and my failures. What do we do on Hanukkah? Where do you bring the light? You bring the light on the lowest of the low. Don't be afraid to shine the light on the things inside of you that are broken and in a state of disrepair. Because just because you have things that are dark, just because you have things that are broken, does not mean you're a bad person. It just means you're a good person with some baggage. You're a good person with some elements of your persona that are in a state of disrepair. Don't go through life ignoring that which is broken. Because if you do that, you simply handicap yourself. What's Chanukah? Chanukah is bringing the light into the lowest areas. So you see, Rabbi Nachman, and this is a theme that Rabbi Nachman teaches us. Don't be afraid to confront your faults. Sometimes the reason we're afraid to confront our faults, because if I acknowledge that I have faults, doesn't that make me a bad person? And Rabbi Nachman says, no, if you have faults, all that means is what? You're human. You're human. So it's okay. It's okay. Rabbi Nachman gives us the license, ultimately, again, to go ahead and confront that which is broken. Because it is only when I confront that which is broken that I have the courage to go ahead and repair it. And it's only through that repair that ultimately growth. You know, Rabbi Nachman understood something amazing. Rabbi Nachman writes about this extensively. I'm just sharing this. I'm choosing this theme because this is a dominant theme in Rabbi Nachman's writings. He says, why is it? He discusses this idea in one of his essays about not getting traction in life. It's actually a very personal piece that he writes. He says, you know, I've been working on the same things for so many years, yet I don't seem to be getting any life traction. Sounds familiar? Good. Right? Sounds very familiar for me, right? Same things, right? The truth is, I think many of us confront this, especially like Yomim Noron, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. I decide all things I'm going to work on. And then I realize, wow, that's interesting, because the stuff I want to work on this year, I said that last year, right? And actually, I said it the year before, and I think for many of us, I've been saying the same things for the last 10 years, maybe 20 years, maybe entire lifetime. So Rabbi Nachman, and by the way, isn't it validating? You thought it was just me and you. Now, Baruch Hashem, it's good that we're in good company. Rabbi Nachman had the same problem. He says, so why is it? Why is it that I can't get the traction to do the things that I want to do? And he says something amazing. You know, the Gemara quotes a concept of Tovel V'Sheretz B'Yad, without getting too graphic over here. The person is ritually impure, so I have to go to the mikvah. I immerse in the mikvah. So imagine I immerse in the mikvah. There's only one detail. I'm holding a dead rodent in my hand, right? So I go up, I go down, I splash around 10 times, 15 times. Fantastic. What's my status when I come out of the mikvah? I'm still ritually impure. Why? Because even though I've immersed, I'm holding onto the impurity in my hand. And so Rabbi Nachman says, the Gemara tells us, until you decide to let go of the impurity, ultimately, again, the mikvah doesn't accomplish anything. So Rabbi Nachman says, so many times in life, the reason I don't get traction is because I'm unwilling to deal with the sheretz, with the rodent that's in my hand. There's something dead and decaying in my hand. There are parts of me that are in a fundamental state of disrepair. I don't want to deal with that. Instead, what I want to do is I'll take on stuff. I'll take on new initiatives. I'll take on new things. I'll grow here. I'll do this. I'll do anything and everything. Just don't make me confront my flaws. Don't make me confront that which is broke. I'll do anything, anything you want. I'll learn Torah, I'll say Tehillim, I'll do Chesed, I'll give Tzedakah, I'll give even more Tzedakah, right? Whatever I have to do, just don't make me confront what's broken inside of me. Rabbi Nachman says, you could do that, but you'll be spinning your wheels. You only get so far if you're unwilling to let go of the sheretz. And that's Rabbi Nachman says over here, that's Chanukah. The essence of Chanukah is, bring the light into the lowest of places. Don't be scared to shine the light on the darkest places where you are broken and where you are in a state of disrepair. Because if you acknowledge your frailties, if you confront your frailties, doesn't make you a bad person, just makes you human. And the moment you acknowledge your humanity, the moment you acknowledge that there are things inside of me that really need to be addressed, is the moment that you have a chance to make yourself into something great. With this, I'm going to conclude. Rabbi Nachman really highlights this. If you take a look on the last page, well, the last two pages, 7 and 8. So this is a copy over here from Likutei Moharan. This is Torah Resh Pei Beis. This is perhaps one of the most important pieces by Rabbi Nachman, meaning if you don't learn anything else in Likutei Moharan, but you just learn this piece, you've led an accomplished life. So look what Rabbi Nachman says over here. This is incredibly beautiful. We're not going to do all of it, but I just want to highlight something incredibly profound to you. Paragraph A. Ki tzarech lodin es kala adam lekafsechos. Okay? So the Rebbe starts over here by saying you have to judge every person favorably. Or maybe stated a little bit differently, you have to give every person the benefit of the doubt. Okay? Va'afilu mishu rasha gamar. What happens if you look at someone and you say, you know what? That person has no redeeming qualities. No, he's a Russia. However you would know that. Right? That person is a total Russia. Right? That person is totally evil through and through. Rabbi Nachman still says, Sarich lechapis velimtzobo ezo ma'at tov. You still have to go ahead and look for something good in every person. Every person has something good. Sheba'osa ma'at ino rasha. Every person has something redeeming. You know, the Balatanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, quotes this concept as well. And he says something amazing. He says that the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, Hevi mitamidav shel Aaron. Person should be the first chapter of Pirkei Avos. Be of the disciples of Aaron. Oev shalom, love peace. Rodev shalom, pursue peace. Ohev es habrios, love brios, people. Umikarvan l'Torah, bring them closer to Torah. So the Baal HaTanya asks an interesting question. He says, why does it say ohev es habrios? Bria is a very generic term. Right? We know that the Mishnah means it's referring to people. But bria could refer to what? Almost like anything, any creation. Any creation, right? The bria is any creation. So why does it say brios? And the Baal HaTanya says something amazing. Quotes the same idea. He says, you know, you always have to try to find something redeeming in people. And for some people, the only redeeming factor they have is that they walk on two legs instead of four. But at least that's something. At least that's something. Right? Every person has to have some redeeming factor inside of them. Therefore, says Rabbi Nachman, person has to look for that. There's od ma'at ve'ino rasha. Right? There's always something redeeming that a person has inside of them. If you skip down a little bit, he quotes the pasuk from Tehillim, right before paragraph B, quotes over Tehillim Lam Zayin, v'od ma'at ve'in rasha. So Rabbi Nachman understands that phrase, od ma'at ve'in rasha. Just to understand what King David was saying actually in that phrase, is od ma'at ve'in rasha, there will come od ma'at in a little bit, there will be no more wickedness. It's a metaphorical allusion to messianic redemption. Mashiach will come and evil will cease to exist. Rabbi Nachman interpreted it a little bit differently. Od ma'at ve'in rasha. Every person has an od ma'at, a little bit inside of them that's not tainted by evil. Every person has an od ma'at, a little bit inside of them, ve'in rasha. Where even if I've compromised 98%, every person has a little bit in them that's untainted. He skips down a little, I will skip down a little bit. He goes on and he says, skip to paragraph D. So the Rebbe begins by talking about being down the kafskos, judging people favorably. Then he says, v'havein, v'chein tzarech ha'adam linso gam ba'atzmo. This is so beautiful. Every person has to look inside of themselves and find something good inside of themselves. Kizei yadua. Here we go. Shetzarech ha'adam lihizare ma'od lios besimcha tamid. A person must always be exceptionally vigilant, to always be happy, to always be joyous. Ulaharchik ha'atzvus ma'od ma'od. And to push away sadness as much as possible. So I just want to point something out to you. What did Rabbi Nachman mean when he said, Mitzvah gidola lios besimcha tamid? It's a very mitzvah to always be with simcha. What didn't he mean? What didn't he, and I said, Obran, what didn't he mean? So not to be surrounded by darkness. Remember, what it doesn't mean is, he can't literally mean that you're supposed to be actively joyous at all times. First of all, no one's ever always joyous. Number two, there are times in life where you're not supposed to be joyous, right? Person chas v'shalom loses a loved one, right? There's a mitzvah of avelos, right? Of shiva, tisha b'av. There are times you're not supposed to be joyous. Rabbi Nachman understood true joy comes from living a life of meaning. That's what he means when he says, mitzvah gidola lios besimcha tamid. How can you be in a constant state of simcha? By living a meaningful existence. And we know this from ourselves. When are you happiest in life? Let's be honest. You're not happiest when you're on vacation. Vacation is very nice. Most of us tend to tire of vacation after a little while. It's nice. It's nice. That's not when you're happiest. You're happiest in life when you feel most accomplished. Whether it's career-wise, whether it's during communal activities, when you feel that you've just done something of importance and of significance, that's when you feel happy. Mitzvah gedol lios besimcha tamid is the charge to lead a constantly meaningful life. Where there is meaning, there is joy. Maybe not the kind of joy that puts a smile on your face, but that's not that may be real joy, may not be real joy. Real joy is a sense of happiness, a sense of joy, simcha that comes on the inside, that comes on the heels of dynamic life accomplishment. So Rabbi Nachman says, but in order to do that, you have to what? You have to believe that you're a good person. You have to believe that you're a worthwhile person. And says Rabbi Nachman, so many of us walk around thinking that we're broken, that we're damaged, that we're unsalvageable, unsavable, and not worth anything. Therefore, says Rebbe, what does a person have to do? A person has to go ahead and find something good inside of themselves. Find something good. And by the way, you might think, no, that's not true. People don't walk around like that. I want to tell you something, my friends. So many people, if you're not one of these people, consider yourself lucky. So many people walk around thinking that they're subpar. So many people walk around thinking that they don't measure up. So many people walk around thinking that they're worthless, that they don't matter, that if I were to disappear tomorrow, it wouldn't make a difference to anyone. So many people walk around life thinking that all they're doing is taking up space and they don't matter at all. They don't matter at all. You know, I mentioned this on Shabbos. This past week was the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And I saw an incredible interview with a woman. Her name was Rivka Leibovitz. She was very young. I don't know how old she was, but it sounds like she was a child when Auschwitz-Birkenau was liberated. So remember, again, the Nazis, Yimach Shem V'Zichram, left. So the camp was unattended for a little while. The Russians came in on January 27th. So she was describing what happened when the Nazis left. I mentioned this in a different shir also. That the first thing they went is they went to the storehouses for food. And they took bread. She said, like, people thought I was bloated. She said, I wasn't bloated. I just stuck bread everywhere because I just wanted bread. Then they got warm clothing. The Russians came in. And she said something amazing. She said, there was a Russian soldier who saw her. And the soldier was very moved by the sight of this little girl. And he lifted her up and he cradled her in his arms and he started crying. And she says, to this day, I can still feel his tears coming down onto my cheek. And she said, I didn't know what was happening in this moment. She said, here is this man holding me like a baby, cradling me. And she said, I didn't know that there was anyone in this world who cared about me. She said, I had my mother was gone. I had a father, my father was gone. My family was gone. And I was sure that there was no one else in the world who cared about me. And in this moment, this soldier who I didn't know until 5 minutes before cradled me like I was his own child, and I realized that there are people in this world who still care about me. How many people walk through life thinking that no one cares about them, that they don't matter, that they don't measure up, that they're just simply not worthwhile, that they don't... things don't change. People don't change. What people struggled with 200 years ago, 300 years ago, the same thing we struggle with today. Inadequacy, a lack of self-worth, a feeling like I don't measure. Rabbi Nachman says, you have to work on that. What's the first step? This is free advice. Rabbi Nachman says the first step is find something good inside of yourself. See, a lot of times the reason why we walk around with feelings of inadequacy or lack of self-worth is because we feel that we are devoid of good. I'm devoid of good. Rabbi Nachman says, okay, I'm going to give you homework. I'm going to give you exercise. Find something good inside of yourself. And he goes on. Look at the end of paragraph D. V'afilu kishemaschil istakel ba'atzov rosh ein bo shum tov v'molei chatoim v'rotza ba'dover la'apilu al yedei ze ba'atzos umor shchora. So this, by the way, is another piece that is incredibly amazing in Rabbi Nachman's statement. Thank you. In Rabbi Nachman's statement, which is, in Rabbi Nachman's worldview, the greatest existential spiritual threat is not sin. It's not sin. Why is it not sin? I have news for you. Everyone sins. We all sin. We all sin. Some of us sin a lot. Some of us sin really a lot. Right? Some of us sin little. There are very few people who sin very little. Right? Most of us are sinning a lot or really a lot. Right? So that's not the greatest existential danger to the Jew. The greatest existential danger is melancholy, is depression, is sadness, which Rabbi Nachman means giving up on yourself. The moment that you think that you're worth nothing, that's the moment that you're done. Sin, you could always rebound from sin. You could always rehabilitate in the aftermath of sin. No matter how bad the sin is, there is always a path to rehabilitation. But the moment you give up on yourself is the moment you are lost in the darkness. So I begin the process of, what I have to do in order to save myself, I have to find something good. I have to find something redeeming. Look at paragraph E. He says, what happens? Still the same page, right? It's paragraph E. I have to find something good inside of myself. Every person has to have something positive inside of them. So what happens? So says Rabbi Nachman, you know what happens? I find something good. Good, mazel tov. I found something good inside of myself. Then what happens? You know, we have this concept of the Yetzer Hara, right? So I don't know how we translate. What's a good English translation? Evil inclination. So remember, again, sometimes we have this image of like this little person on my shoulder, you know, in the red suit with the horns and the pitchfork and this. So we don't believe in that. Wrong religion, right? We don't have that. What's the Yetzer Hara? The Yetzer Hara are the self-sabotaging internal mechanisms that we were created with. How many times in life does it happen that I'm doing something and then I pull the rug out from under myself? No one did it to me. No one did it to me. It's no one's fault. I did it to myself. And I wonder, why did I do that? Why did I self-sabotage? That internal self-sabotaging mechanism is what we call the Yetzer Hara. Chiddush Baruch Hu programmed us with that because that is the very engine for growth. Without that, there'd be no friction or pushback to growth. Yes, I self-sabotage. Done it many, many, many times. Too many times to count. That's what I have to try to overcome. So what happens? I begin the process of looking inward to try to find something good. I find something good. Mazel tov. I found something good and redeeming. Then what happens? The self-sabotaging mechanism kicks in. And then what occurs? So listen to this. So what happens? Then I find something good. So then what do I begin to say to myself? It wasn't really so good. Right? I did it, but it was really deficient. So I did the mitzvah, whatever you follow me, whatever mitzvah it is. I did the mitzvah, but the mitzvah was deficient in this way and that way. And I know I tried, but at the end of the day, even the good things that I do are still deficient. Rabbi Nachman goes on and he explains. If you look at the paragraph F, he says, Rabbi Nachman says, if you're looking for the perfect mitzvah, good luck. No one has ever performed the perfect mitzvah. No one will ever perform the perfect mitzvah. But the idea is find some element of good in yourself. And this becomes a major doctrine in Rabbi Nachman's writing, Rabbi Nachman's thought, which is no matter how badly you've messed up in life, find the good inside of you. And when you find that good, use it as the springboard for personalistic rehabilitation. Use that as the springboard for growth. Use that as the springboard for change. Do not give up on yourself. There is never someone who is beyond repair. There is never someone ultimately, again, who is devoid of good. Sometimes you could eradicate a lot of good through negative activity. Sometimes you could obscure a lot of good ultimately, again, through a lot of bad decisions and bad choices. But there is always good inside of you. No matter how badly you've messed up in life, no matter how many wrong turns you've made, no matter how many poor choices or decisions, ultimately, again, I am saddled with. At the end of the day, od ma'at ve'ein rasha. There is always the little bit of me that is still good, the little bit of me that is untainted, the little bit of me that is spiritually luminescent and pure. And if I have the courage to discover it, I can use that as the initial building blocks to rebuild myself into something great. This is a theme that Rabbi Nachman stresses over and over and over. It's not his theme. The truth is there are people who espouse this same theme before him. The Baal Shem Tov HaKadosh espoused this particular theme. But I think that this is perhaps one of the most empowering themes, not just in Hasidus, but in Judaism. So many times in life we write ourselves off because of a series of bad mistakes, sometimes years and decades of bad mistakes. And the Rebbe says, just always remember one simple phrase, od ma'at ve'ein rasha. There is always a little bit of untainted self inside of me. If I could just dig down and discover it, I could use it ultimately again as the building blocks and as the catalyst to rebuild myself. So although I have not done justice to Rabbi Nachman, there's so much more, both biographically and both Torah-wise, hopefully at least been able to give you a little bit of a taste, a little bit of an appreciation, and a little bit of a, you know, the Jewish people, we are privileged to have had so many wonderful leaders. We have wonderful leaders today. Baruch Hashem, we have an incredible history of illustrious leaders. Different leaders appeal to different segments, to different groups, and really serve different roles at different times. But there are some people whose thoughts and ideas and approaches really transcend sectarianism, really transcend all the groupings we tend to make. And I think Rabbi Nachman is one of those personalities. Whether a person is a chassid or not a chassid, whether a person embraces Breslov, doesn't embrace Breslov, that's your own decision. But at the end of the day, the ideas of the Rebbe, the life tenets of the Rebbe, and the life story of the Rebbe is something that Emir Hashem hopefully could inspire all of us to become the best version of ourselves. Thank you.